Welcome to this RCGP podcast on Aspergillus-related disease in primary care. I'm Dr. Tony Hazel, GP and Deputy Medical Director for e-learning at the RCGP. Today, I'll be talking to Dr. Kevin Griffith-Jones. Many of you will have heard Kevin already as he's a regular speaker at GP conferences. He is a GP based in Wiltshire with a variety of interests in respiratory health, including being on the Policy Committee of the Primary Care Respiratory Society, on the NICE Asthma Guidelines Committee, and on the steering group for the British Thoracic Society cough guideline. He's also currently a clinical advisor to the RCGP, having previously been college respiratory lead and clinical champion. Thanks for speaking to us today, Kevin.
That's a pleasure, Tony. Thanks for inviting me along to talk about a subject which may not be immediately obvious to us as GPs, but which is just lurking under the surface in primary care and is probably more common than we think.
Yes, absolutely. So this podcast is part of a course on aspergillosis, which also includes an e-learning module and a screencast. And I'd encourage anyone listening to have a look at the rest of the course. And as you say, this isn't something we commonly pick up in primary care and isn't something I knew a huge amount about before I started working on this course. But we don't find what we don't look for. So maybe we should start with the basics. What is it and when should we think about looking for it?
Well, Aspergillus species are molds which are commonly found in soil, organic matters, and sometimes in air conditioning units. They're on average about 2.5 microns in diameter, which means they're easily respirable and cause potential damage to the lungs, either directly or via immune-mediated damage. Aspergillus species can cause respiratory disease as well as in other body systems. Whilst anyone could be affected by aspergillosis, the groups of patients in whom the diagnosis is more likely would include those with severe asthma or other respiratory conditions, such as COPD or cystic fibrosis, and also specifically in those who are immunocompromised, even in the absence of pre-existing respiratory conditions.
So the e-learning module covers all the various different clinical manifestations of Aspergillus infection and including pictures of some of the dermatological ones. We won't go through all of them now, but this podcast is going to concentrate particularly on allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, or ABPA for short. So what exactly is ABPA?
Well, allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis is a bit of a mouthful, as you can see, so we'll use ABPA. An ABPA is caused by an IgE-mediated allergic reaction to aspergillus, which occurs in susceptible patients, particularly those with asthma or with cystic fibrosis. It causes worsening asthma, often associated with a productive cough with brown sputum, and if untreated, can lead to permanent lung damage, such as bronchiectasis or pulmonary fibrosis. Now, the e-learning module discussed other manifestations of aspergillosis in more detail, such as chronic aspergillosis, hypersensitivity pneumonitis, and other clinical presentations in and outside of the lungs. But as you say, we're going to concentrate here on ABPA.
That's great. Thanks for that clarification. So it might be useful to start with a theoretical patient who has uncontrolled asthma. And what might make you think of aspergillus in that situation?
Well, first of all, it's important anyway that we're aware of our patients who have severe asthma, as secondary care referral can make a huge difference to outcome. The Global Initiative for Asthma Statement, GINA, guideline defines difficult to treat asthma as uncontrolled asthma, despite high dose inhaled steroid long-acting beta-2 combination, plus one other controller therapy. So that accounts to about 17% of patients with asthma have difficult to treat asthma, but only 3.7% have severe asthma. In other words, they remain unwell despite looking at those correctable factors such as adherence and triggers. And in the papers concerning ABPA, these terms appear to be used interchangeably. So when you look at the percentage of our adult population with severe asthma, about 13% of these patients and 11 to 50% of children with difficult to treat asthma have been found to have ABPA. And so ABPA should be on the list of suspects causing poor control in the severe asthmatic. And just one thing to note, a history of exposure to mold is helpful, but not a prerequisite for diagnosis.
Yeah, so it really is probably more common than I think in the patients that I'm seeing with asthma, where we haven't quite got on top of it. And this might be a good time for me to mention that we do also have a course on severe asthma for people who want to know more about that in general. So in such a patient in which we had a suspicion that there might be something else going on, how might you investigate? Can we test for aspergillus in primary care, or is this something that needs to be left to a consultant?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. One of the key points to think about when you have a patient with severe asthma that's poorly controlled is whether there is a significant comorbidity or alternative diagnosis to account for that poor control. To a large extent, the choice of investigation is going to be dictated by the history and clinical examination, but this is likely to include as a basic arranging a chest X-ray or spirometry, for example, to see if there's any evidence of COPD. Sputum analysis might be helpful in identifying significant pathogens such as Pseudomonas, which in turn would raise the suspicion of bronchiectasis. But in addition, given the high prevalence of ABPA in patients with severe asthma, it would be worth checking a full blood count for eosinophilia, total IgE and aspergillus specific IgE and IgG. Now, these are commonly available in general practice, but if you don't have open access to these tests, it may be worth talking to your local lab to see if you can find out how to arrange them. In many cases, you will be referring anyway to a secondary care consultant, because severe controlled asthma should always be referred. But patients with aspergillus-related conditions need to be seen more urgently to prevent lung damage with such long wait for outpatients. So if you do find evidence of an aspergillus-related condition at the time of referral, might well get your patients seen more quickly. So it's well worth doing those blood tests if you're able to do them. If you'd already referred the patient and then the test came back positive, then you should get in contact with the respiratory teams by whatever means you have available, email or advice and guidance, as they would probably upgrade that referral to urgent.
So that's really useful, particularly at a time, of course, when our patients do wait for such a long time for outpatients' clinics. So we know that aspergillus is a mold. I'm sure everyone listening has been in the situation where a patient has come to talk about their housing issues with mold. And it can be tricky, particularly because certainly in my area, housing departments actually ask us not to write in unless we hear from them first. Is it likely that mold in a house or flat will cause respiratory problems in an otherwise well adult or child?
Yeah, so there are lots of studies to show that indoor mold is associated with the development of asthma in children and also increased exacerbations in those who already have asthma. And in adults, there is an increased risk of getting worsening symptoms with asthma if mold is present. Aspergillus-associated pulmonary disease is more prevalent in patients exposed to indoor mold and with pre-existing asthma, cystic fibrosis, or immunosuppression. And the very tragic death in 2020 of a two-year-old boy, Awab Ishak, please forgive my pronunciation, was attributed by the coroner to mold and brought the problem of mold in inadequate housing very much into the media spotlight. Studies which try to remedy those poor conditions which predispose to mold are confounded by other alterations in humidity, temperature, and indoor air quality. But such studies show that when they are carried out, remedial action, there is reduction in asthma symptoms over a 12-month period. So this all ties into all the other things that we know about health inequalities and the social determinants of health. It's much more likely to be an issue in deprived areas. So when we are faced with patients who strongly suspect that mold is a problem, they first of all should be signposted to websites which provide useful information about how to deal with mold problems, how to approach the landlord if they have a landlord, or the council. And these are shown in the resources section of the module on aspergillosis. The UK government in particular, and maybe surprisingly, has a very useful website on understanding the health risks of damp and mold in the home. And this can be found on the website www.gov.uk and just put in damp and mold.
That's great. And as I would repeat what Kevin said, that all of those resources, all of those websites are in the resources section of the e-learning module with clickable links. So finally, coming back to a patient who maybe we've referred with a suspicion of an aspergillus-related disease and they've been seen and it's confirmed, I'm assuming that most of the management will be in secondary care. What sort of management will be used? And do we in primary care have any role?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. For most conditions, the treatment will be initiated in secondary care, although Aspergillus is responsible for otitis externa and some nail infections, which we might initiate ourselves. But really, for the principal things like ABPA and aspergillosis, this will be initiated in secondary care. Drug treatment of ABPA is usually with monotherapy with oral steroids to begin with, probably better outlooks than using antifungal or antifungal treatments, although those are used for an initial attack in patients who might not tolerate oral steroids or might be diabetics. So the oral antifungal agents which are used are called the triazole antifungal agents, such as itraconazole or voriconazole. Treatment of aspergillosis is with oral or intravenous antifungal drugs, and the subacute and acute invasive forms of disease can convey quite a high mortality and may need intensive care treatment. So looking at our local pathways, this may dictate whether all the antifungal drugs get prescribed in secondary care or some are given in primary care using a written shared care agreement, which should also cover any monitoring. Of course, if drugs are given in secondary care, then we should put them on the computer's hospital issue to pick on things like interactions, triazole antifungal agents as cytochrome P450 inhibitors, and also alter the QT interval on ECG. So we must be very aware of interactions when we are giving drugs. Itraconazole needs liver function monitoring if used for more than 1 month, and voriconazole needs liver and renal function as well as regular ECG checking. But that may well be done in secondary care, as is often a red drug for primary care. Patients should also be warned that the antifungal drugs can cause photosensitivity, so patients need to know about using high factor sunscreen and avoiding the midday sun. And for those people who are resistant to antifungal treatment and continue to deteriorate, a monoclonal antibody might be used. Again, that should go on the computer. And also, we need to think about vaccination for these high-risk patients against flu, pneumococcus, and COVID-19. Even if the patient wasn't eligible before the aspergillus-related diagnosis.
That's great. Thank you. So I think that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to say a massive thank you to Kevin for joining us to discuss aspergillus-related disease. Do have a look at the rest of the course. There's much more detail in the e-learning module and the screencast. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed this RCGP podcast, then please have a look at the e-learning website or wherever you usually get your podcasts to find others on a variety of subjects. Thank you and goodbye.
Bye.